We've got to get Bob Berman to sit down. Okay. Is everybody ready for a psychedelic experience? We're here to bring you a psychedelic experience. Welcome to Dallas Philosopher's Forum. Ed, we all ready? We're going to get together here. I'm Ron Olson, director for the Dallas Philosopher's Forum. I want to welcome everyone to this event. We meet on the second and fourth Tuesdays, September through May. And I want to remind you, if you haven't paid already, please pay $5 to Jack Youngkin. Jack, can you raise your hand? We are a non-profit organization, and we look to make sure we get entrance fee if at all possible, so we'd appreciate that. If students with an ID can attend for $2. If you want to be a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. Also, please remember to pay your meal. You'll bring your check afterwards, and please remember to pay your meal and your drinks as you leave. We appreciate that very much. Every once in a while, someone will inadvertently forget to pay. I will remind you to make sure you take care of your bill. We also have a website, www.philosophersforum.com, and that's got a lot of the same, .org, pardon me, that's got a lot of the same information that we're just sharing with you now. Then I ask that you please turn off your cell phone and put them on pleasure or vibrate mode at this time. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. Okay, tonight's presenter is Dr. Tony Roberts, a professor of philosophy and the world of religions from Tarrant County College and a director of their Interdisciplinary Studies Honors Program. His education and career have vacillated between pharmacology and neuroscience. He's the perfect person to talk to. He's a philosopher, studied world religions. Notes, he brought an extra brain with him tonight. He's got a background in neuroscience, pharmacology, world religions, and postmodern literary theory. His writings and presentations have tended to focus on the pedagogical concerns regarding the creation of online learning, which I'm sure they're big at Tarrant County College, a lot of online learning, and these environments in philosophy. Think of Socrates in cyberspace, but his personal research interests are in consciousness studies, which draw upon his interdisciplinary training and experience in neuropsychology, phenomenology, and religion. Tonight, he examines the concept of Good Friday Experiment, the Good Friday Experiment in 1962, and its implications for combining empirical scientific research and philosophical inquiry, the psychedelic soul towards a science of consciousness. And now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Tony Roberts.
Thanks. Very pleased to be with you. I was here, it's just been about 3 years since I've been here. Some familiar faces and not so familiar faces. Welcome all to all of you. I brought my wife with me. She's in the back enjoying margarita right there. Since we can't provide acid for all of you, we've thought about having everyone do shots of tequila for a while so that we can get into the experience, but that was a no-no as well.
Not in the budget.
So not in the budget. But we did have someone in our midst who's had that personal experience, and I think you know who that is. So we could call upon his first-person experience to elaborate. I am a jack of all trades, a master of none.
I can't.
Your brain is in the way of my brain. We have a non-hearer. Here, we're going to. So I will help you out here.
One more chair.
How's that?
Now try it.
Hello, hello. It's there.
Yeah, I think you're on.
We just need to go higher.
I can adjust the volume.
How's that?
Just keep talking.
Now you can hear me. Up.
No, just keep going.
Hello. Okay. After the presentation tonight. We'll have some discussion in the midst of the presentation. I'll pause and we'll have some questions. So we won't hold all the questions to the end. As well as at the end, you're welcome to come up. I brought some books of for various interests. It would help me as well to know some of the interests and experience in the audience. So you who introduced yourself to me, I know are teachers of philosophy and may have some experience studying things in epistemology and consciousness studies and those sorts of things. But elsewhere, any medical practitioners here, neuroscientists, neuropsychologists? Okay, when it gets technical, I'll hand the mic to you.
No.
All right, we'll do that. My wife is a brain injury nurse, but she told me never to hand the mic to her. Though she keeps me grounded. All of this theory, I get excited and I'll explain to her the theory, and she'll look at me and she'll say, but that's not how it works in practice. She works with real people with real organic brain injuries and so forth. So theory, this is a springboard, as most of philosophy is. This is a springboard for thinking. No definitive answers here, especially in the area of consciousness, especially as it concerns the brain, without a question for most of us, the most complex entity in the universe. So here we go. Let's start with some discussion of the Good Friday experiment. I selected this also because of the date and its proximity to Easter. We're thinking about those kinds of things in this area of the world in particular. We'll start off with just a reading for you of an account of what happened on that day. It was Good Friday, April 20th, 1962. 20 ministerial students at Andover Newton Theological Seminary were assembled in a basement room. The basement room of the famous Marsh Chapel on the campus of Brown University. Around them, 10 research assistants, a graduate student and medical doctor by the name of Walter Pankey, like Hanky Panky, yes, there are jokes, and a Harvard professor soon to gain considerable notoriety, Timothy Leary. The assistants distributed a single clear capsule to each participant. 10 of the capsules contain a placebo, nicotinic acid, just enough to give a slight tingling of the lips. And the other contained a small dose of a hallucinogenic agent, psilocybin, which in the body is metabolized into psilocin, extracted from mushrooms, often referred to as the flesh of the gods, as is called among tribal shamans in South America.
That's the love drug.
The love drug. I'll take your word for it. Upon swallowing the capsules, the group is ushered into a small chapel equipped with 2 loudspeakers. As the worship hour approaches, the room is soon filled with the booming voice of Reverend Howard Thurman, chaplain of Boston University and personal mentor to Martin Luther King Jr. His Good Friday service is a moving orchestration of music, scripture reading, poetry, and reflections on the life and crucifixion of Christ. The capsules dissolve. Their contents flow through the guts and into the blood, slipping across the blood-brain barrier where their effect is manifest. The following is a selective but representative account of what the 10 who received the psilocybin reported. There was an energy. It was almost a sexual thing, an intensity, a joy. The visual things that I experienced and the music, I think, were aligned with a sense of unity. Everything was unified.
Yes.
We were all part of the same thing. You didn't sense a difference between the music and the physical. The inner awareness and feelings I had during the experiment were like a dropping away of the external world, and then a sudden sense of singleness, oneness. I remember thinking, this isn't real. And somehow this inner experience of oneness is more real, more authentic than anything I had ever experienced. I closed my eyes, and the visuals were back. The color patterns were back. And it was as if I was in a sea of bands, streams of colors, streaming past me. The colors were brilliant. I could swim down any one of them. But when I couldn't decide, I died. Someone should not have to go through this. It was excruciating to die like that. It's very painful. I died. I lay on the front pew and watched myself pour through my navel and totally become nothing. I felt this would never stop. All of a sudden, I felt sort of drawn out into infinity. And all of a sudden, I had lost touch with my mind. I felt that I was caught up in the vastness of creation. Sometimes you would look up and see the light on the altar, and it would just be a blinding sort of light and a radiation. The main thing was that there was this sense of timelessness. These experiments were very carefully controlled under the watchful eye of a medical physician, Walter Pankey, as well as his mentors. There was a double-blind study, randomized. The persons there conducting the experiment, taking the follow-up interviews and questionnaires, were all objective, not related to the subjects nor the ones doing the study. This may have been one of the first times in history that there was an effort to bring a scientific attitude and methodology to something like religious experience. Pankey himself referred to it as experiential mysticism. He wanted to study it objectively rather than subjectively and ask about feelings and religious interpretations. Usually reports of religious experiences are fraught with particular doctrines and belief systems. People interpret them according to their particular religious tradition. But this was more phenomenological. We ask about the experience itself rather than the interpretation of the experience. And much of these were written down and explained. One thing that that Pankey provides for us is an analysis or a categorizing of these experiences of the 10. You'll notice that there was a post column on both of these, right after the experience, what was reported, and then 6 months, and then another group, not Pankey himself, but another other researchers, come in about 25 years later and meet with these individuals again, at least most of them, to ask these questionnaires again. Questionnaires that were over 100 questions, each of them. I've highlighted some of these in red to call attention to what we'll discuss and focus on tonight. I think you heard from their accounts there was this overwhelming sense of unity or oneness, as if all is one. The universe had folded in upon itself, and that remains consistent over time. The idea of space and time distortion, the slowing down of time, or at some points as if time were not passing at all. Space seems infinite, everywhere and nowhere at the same time, which remains fairly consistent over time. The deep positive mood, the sense of sacredness. Some of this may be attributed to the situation, and they were all ministerial students at a service on Good Friday, so you would expect some sense of sacredness of the moment, not just the meditation. But the next one, objectivity, that it was real, that it had a noetic quality, a certainty to it. Notice the initial score there, about 63%. And as you heard here, one reported, this was the most real thing I had ever experienced. And yet, it couldn't be real, which gives us the next category. It was paradoxical. It was here, it was there, it was inside me, it was outside me, it was real and not real at the same time. But notice, I find this interesting over time, number 5 and number 6. Look what happens after 6 months and 25 years. Notice objectivity or the noetic quality. Notice how it increases over time. And this is natural, and most of you, you can think in your own life. You don't have to be a psychologist to know this. Over time, when you look back upon things in your life, We interpret them one way, and we become more sure of how we've interpreted it over time. Yes, that must be how it was. We tend not to doubt ourselves in the long term. There's a long time to justify and give reasons for why this is indeed the case. But it's also the case, look at number six, the fact that it was paradoxical declines as the rationality increases, reasoning increases. Yes, this really did happen to me. And followed by, over time, well, it really wasn't so paradoxical after all. So this is expected as well. Ineffability, meaning there are no words to describe it. It is beyond words. And this is common in these types of experiences. Transience. It comes and goes. It's not something I can control, as if it's something that happens to me, or I am happening through the experience. I have no free will. I have been taken over by something else. A persisting positive attitude and behavior, a sense of loving kindness towards other people, towards oneself. Here again, these were ministerial students, so that was already present in the population. But this is his chart that is collected there. Now, once these things are collected, the scientist must interpret them. For Pankey, doing doctoral work, a lot of it wanted to see what would happen if we administer psilocybin during a religious service. It was more of a, let's just see what happens kind of thing. But at the time in the 60s, there was not the knowledge in neurobiology, neural anatomy, neuropharmacology, to understand a lot of the precise mechanisms of how this was taking place. He could not answer the question, how was psilocybin, what was it causing these experiences? Was it triggering something within us, some higher level of consciousness that moved us to a different plane of existence? Did it trigger? Did it cause? What was the mechanism? He didn't have that for us. And we would have to wait about 30 years for these things to be unraveled. But one thing, even as these things are unraveled and we understand more about the drugs, as we understand more about the brain, there are still those philosophical conundrums that he could not solve, and we cannot solve today. David Chalmers calls this the hard problem in philosophy of consciousness. That being, I can understand all about the brain, what neurons do, what neurochemicals are going where, but I can't for the life of me figure out how this 3-pound mass inside my head, something physical, gives rise to subjective experiences like the color red, the sound of a dog barking, the feeling of love. This table is physical. It doesn't feel love or red or the note B flat. My brain is physical. The neurochemicals are physical. How does something physical give rise to the subjective? How does neurons within my brain, nerve cells, and we'll spend some time talking tonight about these pyramidal cells in the cortex, give rise to this experience. Maybe this is the time to hand out the tequila. And experience this feeling. One of my favorite writers is William James. I love his work. He's a great writer. I often think his brother should have done something else, and he should have been the writer. William James remarks in his own particular way, something definite happens to a certain brain state, a certain consciousness corresponds. It's stretching for language. What is consciousness? I can't point to anything in the brain and say, there it is. There's the consciousness module. Consciousness is not tables and chairs and molecules and nerves. So what is it about this stuff in my head that gives rise to the consciousness, the feeling, as Antonio Damasio says, the feeling of what happens, or others refer to it as the quality of our experience, or the qualia. This is the perpetual dilemma. Sometimes we refer to this as an explanatory gap. We have on one side the materiality of the world and how it works, and on the other side the subjective, immaterial experience. And there's this huge gap between these two things. I can interview people and ask them, what are they experiencing? And they can tell me, and paint for me, and dance for me, and sing for me. I can put someone in an MRI scan and see what's happening to the brain when they're dancing or singing or talking. But there seems to be this gap requiring a leap from one area to the other. Tonight, I will not bridge that gap, but I am suggesting to you and for our discussion tonight that if we can move those two antinomy of reason a little bit closer together by way of psychedelics. Because the psychedelic experience gives us something that ordinary experience and consciousness does not, and that is conscious awareness of consciousness as it is coming about. Self, personhood, who I am, time and space, becoming conscious of itself as it is being formed. First, a little neuroscience. I hope not to bore you with this, but we'll get a few nuts and bolts out of the way on that side. Inside our heads is a 3-pound mass of goo. This big plastic thing is much larger than our natural brains. I'll refer to this as a little bit later. About 3 pounds inside your head. When you're born, this pound of goo, this roughly a pound or so of goo, is roughly the consistency of thick shampoo. We handle children's heads very carefully. Over time, it begins to solidify a little bit to the consistency, perhaps, of thick yogurt, maybe custard a little bit. It is a very fragile organ inside our brain, floating in a bath of fluid, enveloped in fluid. And this is one reason also why head injuries are so devastating, because of the rocking back and forth and the injury that would happen naturally just for those sorts of things that my wife as well, people, as they say, touch the brain, never the same. The brain is actually composed of billions and billions, sounds like Carl Sagan, billions and billions of nerve cells, specialized cells, unlike other cells in our body. You have inside your brain, or composing your brain, about 100 billion nerve cells. You have about 200 billion when you're born, and you lose about half of those during your first few years of life. It's sort of like a biological insurance policy. That's why you can get dropped on your head and still operate just fine. Now, there's lots of pruning that goes on with the brain. But these very simple nerve cells, a nucleus like an ordinary cell, have these projections off of them called axons and dendrites, by which they communicate or send neural messages from one nerve cell to the other. And over time, as we have experiences, and because of your particular DNA, because of your particular environment and experience, these dendrites and axons begin to sprout like branches of a tree and almost hook up with one another. Imagine trees growing outside and bending their branches toward one another so that they can communicate with one another. I learned a couple of summers ago when we were on a trip in Colorado that aspen trees actually do that. The roots beneath them actually intertwine and connect with one another. Sounds a bit like that movie Avatar. Did y'all see Avatar, where the whole planet is interconnected beneath? Well, this is how your brain is, interconnected. The nerve cells don't actually touch. From this one, this area, you can see the end of one nerve cell, this is called an axon, this projection, is almost touching this area called the dendrite. They don't touch, but they release chemical messengers across this synaptic gap, which allows electrical impulse to pass from one nerve cell to the other. And notice the little balls inside the end there at the end of the axon. These contain neurochemicals, special molecules that when released, if you see these little blue dots being released down at the bottom, they act like the old metaphor when I was in pharmacy school in the 70s at the University of North Carolina. We used to use the metaphor of a lock and key. In order to open a door, you must have a particular lock to get you in. And the neurochemicals in your brain, there are over 50 different neurochemicals in the brain, unlock particular channels on the other side, symbolized by these purple blobs here. Here they're expanded. This little blue circle right here would represent the neurotransmitter that hooks up to this doorway. And when it does, it opens the channel which allows ions to pass through. The threshold is reached and an impulse begins on the next nerve cell. So it's traveling from one to another, one to another. In the same way, but like I would communicate with one of you. Remember the game we played when we were little? Secret, I've got a secret. And I would tell you something and you'd pass it to the next person and you'd pass it to the next person. This is what happens in the brain. There's this, all this connectivity and discussion within the brain. That's going on. Very, very complex. Okay. So how does this, let's relate this back to our experience with psilocybin. Psilocybin, along with other hallucinogens like DMT and LSD, look very much like a naturally occurring neurochemical in the brain called serotonin. Evolutionarily speaking, biologists believe that serotonin may be one of the earliest neurotransmitters in life. It is even found in Paramecium, single cell organisms. So it is very basic to our whole body. You can find serotonin in the gut. You can find it in the organs. You can find it in the brain. Notice the all of these have this characteristic benzene ring and a nitrogen group here, this indole group and a nitrogen off this side. With psilocybin, these magic mushrooms, notice that it looks almost identical, except the hydroxyl group here is in the sixth position instead of the five position. By the way, this is why serotonin, you might see in the literature written as 5-HT, is in the fifth hydroxyl position. The only thing that is a bit more different is the ethyl groups that are off the side. So it looks almost identical. This key would fit into a lock where this key would fit. They look very similar. Notice that LSD, a synthetic chemical, not occurring naturally, looks a lot different. However, it retains that basic indole group. Other hallucinogens look similar, like mescaline from peyote cactus. It looks similar, though the indole group is split here and opened up a little bit. So hallucinogens look like a naturally occurring chemical in the brain. And if neurons within the brain require neurochemicals, you can imagine that if we take something like psilocybin, it's going to have similar effects to serotonin in the body. However, because of this slight difference, psilocybin will not fit into all the locks and doors within the brain. But it will fit into some others that we'd rather it not fit into. And thus, the side effects. This is the basis for side effects of just about every medicine you take. The Greek word for pharmacy, by the way, it comes from a Greek word, pharmakon. And pharmakon has a double meaning. Pharmakon means cure, and it also means poison. That which will cure you will also kill you in different concentrations, obviously. All right, a little bit more on serotonin. What does it do in the brain and where is it found? Almost all the serotonin in the brain is produced in the brainstem in the Roth-I nucleus here, and then it's distributed throughout the brain to the thalamus in the center of your brain. The thalamus is like the switching station of the brain. Everything but your smell flows into the thalamus. Imagine this being like a train yard, where all the trains come into the train yard, and then whoever the yard director determines whether they're going to go to New York or California or Mississippi. the thalamus sends these messages to the appropriate area in the cortex. So from the thalamus, you might get coming through your eyeballs here, would come to the thalamus, here this orange section in the middle, and then that message, if wired appropriately, would wind up in the occipital lobe in the back of your head, and this is where visual processing occurs. If there's a problem with the activity of serotonin in the thalamus, then what comes through my eyes might wind up in an auditory area. So you might say something like, "Oh, the blue, doesn't it sound beautiful?" And this is exactly what we would experience. Synesthesia is the word, very good. There are some persons who are naturally synesthetes. I don't know if any of you would admit to that. That when they have an experience of a particular color or a shape, they naturally will hear a bell ring, or a particular tone, or a particular color. All ones are yellow. All nines are blue. All squares are orange or have a particular tone to them because the wiring goes in different places. But mess with the serotonin system in the thalamus and you get synesthesia. Much of the serotonin will also go to basal areas. The amygdala, I can't show you that on my brain because it's deeper inside. Amygdala is responsible for fight or flight, love and attachment. A woman has a new baby and she's breastfeeding, that oxytocin triggers the release of other neurochemicals, catecholamines in the blood, and there is nothing you can do to take that baby away from her. She is a mama bear, tight. This is the most beautiful thing in the world, even though it's wrinkled and red and, you know, is yucky. She is immediately attached to that. So that's amygdala. The hippocampus, where we form short-term memories. And then much of the serotonin moving up to the cortex in this area. We're going to talk a little bit about what happens in the prefrontal cortex with these agents in just a minute. Prefrontal cortex. But there's the serotonin. You notice in yellow down at the bottom, I've listed some receptor subtypes. Serotonin not only fits into one particular serotonin lock, there are multiple types of receptors for serotonin in different areas of the brain. And serotonin, you would say, does different things in different parts of the brain. To use a common metaphor, sometimes it makes things go fast, and sometimes it makes it go slow, and sometimes it shuts things off entirely. So serotonin works differently and is determined by each of these receptors. We're going to concern ourselves mostly with the prefrontal lobes and the 5-HT2A and C and HT1A. Don't worry, that's about as complicated as it's going to get tonight. So thank you for...
HT is hypothalamus.
For pretty... Say again?
HT is hypothalamus.
That's serotonin. That's another name for serotonin. It has to do with where the hydroxy group is in the adult.
Isn't the pineal gland in there also?
Yes. I can't see if I have a pineal gland. Right back here. It's a little sticky down thing that's almost at the base of the brain. It is responsible for some of the sleep and wake cycles. This is melatonin. You're exactly right. This is the area, by the way, for those of you in philosophy, the French philosopher René Descartes believed that this was the center of the soul, was right here. This is, to use a modern language, this was kind of like the microphone by which the soul talked to the body. You know, this little sticky down thing you could imagine pulling down, and the soul is communicated, move your arm, and the arm goes up. And it was because you ate food, like you did tonight, that these animal spirits, these vital spirits, come from the animal, from the food. And these animal spirits that you eat are not entirely physical, not entirely spiritual, but this is where they're active, in this area that is not quite physical, not quite spiritual. It has some great illustrations in his work. If you see in the 1600s, the way he thought that the mind and the brain interacted with one another, sort of shouting across this gap of being. he would be very disappointed to know that the only thing this thing does is wake you up and put you to sleep.
Some people think it's a doorway.
It is a doorway. Well, it is, in a sense, it's a doorway to sleep. You know, it is a gland, so its function is to produce. It's not like these other areas within the brain. Its function is to produce this hormone that acts in other areas, which is kind of an odd pathway. It actually goes down your spine and then back up again directly. Each drug has its own thumbprint, as it were, of phenomena, what we experience when we take this drug. This happens to be psilocybin. At very low doses, you can see the orange area right here in the middle. We've got some mild visual alterations. The images are rather vivid. But we don't see much synesthesia, this mixing of experiences. Odd thing about Pankey and Leary's studies, he gave them only 30 milligrams of psilocybin. And the usual dose of psilocybin is about 1 to 3. A higher dose is up to 10 milligrams. So what they experienced was very minuscule. You can imagine, you tell from the reading, you know, this sense of awe and wonder. What would have happened if he had given them 10 grams, you know, of this stuff? At that point, there is great synesthesia, but almost no anxiety at all, a less impairment of cognition here, but this experience of unity. One thing, look at this. You find this strange? They don't report what was called religious experience. Did you notice something was missing in these reports that you would have thought would have been there, sitting in a chapel?
God.
Jesus. It's Good Friday, for Pete's sake. You would expect ministerial students would see Jesus coming towards them, would feel a sense of guilt and forgiveness, overwhelmed joy, ideas of heaven and eternal life. But these are absent in these experiences. Almost universally, they don't have particular religious context. That is not the same with other drugs. But with psilocybin, they're often not associated with a religion in particular. Just to give you a reference, the anesthetic ketamine, which is often, it has some hallucinogenic properties, has this fingerprint. Notice the synesthesia, the imagery is not so much, but this great sense of disembodiment that happens. I am not myself. I find myself floating. My hand is not my hand. This alien hand syndrome. Which, by the way, if you were to read about some of those things, one of my favorite books is by the neuroscientist Oliver Sacks, the man who mistook his wife for a hat. wonderful accounts of his work with persons with organic brain disease. And this is the alien hand syndrome. Kind of like Dr. Strangelove, you remember that old movie? Those kind of experiences.
Phantom of the Mind also.
Yes, Phantoms of the Mind by Ramachandra. That as well, but that's a little bit harder to read. See, now you have that experience. That's right. All right. Now, as philosophers, we're often concerned with presuppositions and what kinds of thoughts and ideas are brought into a scientific study. What you bring into the study with you often shapes what comes out of the study, and this is true of any study, but philosophers have the unusual gift or curse of picking at those things. For me and my foray into language and postmodern language and those sorts of things, I tend to focus on language sorts of things and how people speak and how they label things. When we begin to describe these, consider this, some of the basic words that we take for granted. Psychedelic. What does the word mean? You say, well, I had a psychedelic experience. Psyche is from the Greek, which means soul. Psyche, soul. And the Greek idea of mind is nous. And with people like Plato, although he differs in his writings, there's the idea that the mind is actually part of the immaterial soul, one part of the immaterial soul. He said there were three parts. There were the passions, the idea for lust and anger and aggression, and what he called the higher emotions like love and loyalty, and then mind, three parts. And only humans, he said, had mind. Only animals had a two-part soul, these passional parts, as well as the animal parts. And then vegetables have a vegetative soul, and plants can turn towards the light their roots go down. And that language still plays into modern society. When grandma can no longer speak and she's in a coma, we say she's in a what kind of state?
Vegetative.
Vegetative state. She's a vegetable. Why do we call grandma a vegetable? Well, it's a throwback to Plato's idea of she doesn't even have that basic movement at all. People who tend to be very aggressive, full of rage and anger, or very emotional, we say they're behaving like an animal. And this plays into ideas, how we use this language when we're talking about issues of life and death, or imprisonment, incarceration, or justifications for war. Often we will not point to people and name them in justifying the conditions of war. We'll say, well, the terrorist, the animal, the vicious person. And if you can look through history and find many of the calls for war vilify people by referring to them as having only this animal soul. Animate soul, but only humans had a mind. And of course, there was some discussion. Here, ladies, I'm just a messenger here. In ancient times, there was this great debate as to whether women actually had a mind or not, and certainly that it was not as well formed as a man. This is also one of the reasons why the women could not occupy high positions of authority within religion. Only the mind is close to God, and those with more mind can serve in the priesthood. Those that are more like animals, having an animal soul than competitive soul. By the use of the psychedelics, we're referring to, these are soul uncovering, soul manifesting from the Greek deluon, as if you're unwrapping something, deluon. You're unwrapping a soul and showing. So these drugs actually unwrap or show the soul. Is that what's happening here? Is it an uncovering or a manifestation? Is this consciousness expanding, as it were? Another term that is used, psycholytic, soul breaking, tearing, pulling apart, as in the word analysis, analytic, to pull apart. Are we pulling apart the soul here? And this carries the idea of a consciousness dampening. Something is being pulled apart, no longer unified, as it were. Psychedelic was actually coined in the 1940s. Osmond, I believe, does that sound familiar?
Oh, yeah.
Osmond in the 1940s? Henry. He started working with mescaline first. And then LSD, because it was easier to, you know, to form. And he had a good friend, Aldous Huxley. Sound familiar? Aldous Huxley. And he turned Aldous Huxley on to mescaline. And after that, Aldous Huxley wrote his famous book, it's called The Doorways of Perception, right? Taken from the poet Blake, that said, if we were to cleanse or open the doorways of perception, we would see the world as it really is, infinite. He asked his friend Aldous Huxley what he should call this LSD. This, because calling it LSD just wasn't trendy. So he asked the great author, what should we call it? He said, well, let's call it phenerethine. He took a Greek word, phenerethine, to reveal or to show the emotions or the drives, the passion. And he even came up with a little ditty, a little poem. Something like, do you know what the poem is? Does it sound right? To make this mundane world sublime, take a gram of phenerethine. And Osmond didn't like that. He said, no, that's too goofy. I'm going to go with psychedelic. And he came up with his own little saying, something about to soar with angels or to the depths of hell, something psychedelic. I forget. I'm not a poet, but anyway, it's his own kind of thing.
Did you say Osmond?
Osmond.
I was thinking of Al Stanley Owens. Osmond was later.
Yeah, this was in the 1940s, but it didn't really come about until the 50s. Well, one thing that we can say, well, I'll mention later about some of the therapeutic benefits. In the 1940s, he found that when people took LSD, they seemed to have the same experience as the people with schizophrenia. So he conjectured, is it because the molecule looks sort of like acetylcholine, maybe people with schizophrenia have an imbalance of acetylcholine. He was wrong. But it was the first time in history, at least recorded, that somebody associated a molecule, something physical, with a psychological disorder. And this became exceedingly liberated for people who had been playing as demon-possessed, you know, the history of the word hysterical. Your parents raised you wrong. They didn't potty train you in time. The asylums in France and in Europe in particular, where these people got these horrific labelings. So this was just huge. In fact, I'll take for just a minute. So it helped me with the time. I need a time.
Okay, so we only try and go about 15 minutes or so, and there are about 20, 25 minutes of questions.
I'm going to embed some of the questions in here, so we can do that. All right. I teach a lot of distance learning classes, like I'm trying to put Socrates in cyberspace. And it's wonderful for conversations because there's this anonymity. Students can talk on the discussion board without fear of being ridiculed in an open classroom, so they can say anything they want in the discussion board, and no one knows who it is. But after this discussion about mind and consciousness was happening, and people were throwing around various ideas, there was a woman who made the confession. She wanted everyone to know. Said how liberating this was to understand something about the brain she had done earlier. She said, "I am the wife of a pastor of a very small, rather fundamentalist, experiential, charismatic church. After my second child, I had postpartum depression that was rather severe. The church interpreted this as a kind of demon possession, which also they pointed the finger at her husband, the pastor. Surely there is something going on in the home to cause the wife of the minister to have this, these type of demonic experiences." And it was about to split the church. They were about to be run out of town when she invited her gynecologist to come and speak at the church, and they allowed a woman to speak, which is unusual. But after discussing how hormones work in the body and the relationship between neurotransmitters and personality and emotion, and what would happen as she gave this woman estrogen and some other things to regulate the hormone levels in her body, that no, it wasn't a demon, or as they would say, learning how God made my body now helps me live in harmony with the way God made me. And it was very liberating to that church. So you could imagine during the 40s and 50s at this groundbreaking work, and it all grows out of something as spurious as taking LSD. All right, some other terms. Entheogenic, within, theo is in theos, God, genic, genesis, creating the God within, often is described. It's a mystical experience from the Greek mysterion, also related to mythos or myth, to tell the untellable. And it carries the idea that when you tell a myth, it is traditional. You can imagine the Homeric epics or sitting around a campfire in a tribal culture. When the shaman or the storyteller begins to tell, they will say, "The story is telling itself through me. I have entered into the mystery, and I'm not just revealing to you information. I am embodying the mysterion, the mystery." And so this is how people often describe this, is I have tapped into some mysterion that I can't control. It's not really me the one doing it. It's telling, the universe is telling itself through me, as it were. So it's called mystical. And then some will say this is a religious experience. in the basic understanding of the word religion. We often think of religion as confessional. Here's a list of things you have to believe. Here are the rituals that you must perform. The word, the Latin word, religion, or religious, comes from and ligare. Ligare meaning to bind together, like our ligaments, bind bone to bone. So a religare is literally to bind together again. Which if you're binding together again, that assumes that something was broken, and now it must be religare. So these agents are binding us back in some fundamental way to the sacred, and so religion in that sense. Well, for all, you know, of this talk with these terms, they carry these presuppositions. And if you go into the experience or you report the experience as it was a psychedelic experience, it was a religious experience, it was a mystical experience, that is a bit more interpretive than I'm comfortable with. So that brings us to the first discussion point, if you want to contribute to our discussion here as we look together. Some questions. What is meant by the words mind, soul, God, or sacred in these contexts? Is it something particular? Are we speaking metaphorically? Here's another one. I'll throw this up too, and we'll just deal with them both at the same time. What is implied in saying that these drugs manifest or create or unmask the mind, soul, or God? I'm not asking you to speak personally what you think these are, but if you could project into the mind of these practitioners, those who engage in these practices, who have these experiences, and they describe them as entheogenic or psychedelic, why use these terms? What might they mean?
They
want to go for that one.
They describe it, whatever, as a sense feeling of, a sense of, a louder sense of the infinite or time stops, a feeling of or sense of. It's more of a feeling than a thought.
Okay.
And it's deep. And that's really kind of they don't seem to be able to describe it.
Right.
Better.
So they're struggling for words, but why select these words? Have any thoughts? If not, we'll move on. I'm just, you know, throwing things out there. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
In my personal experience on all three of these drugs, I had what they want to call me. I had God talk to me.
Uh-huh.
And I'm an atheist. I've been an atheist since I was 16 years old. And I have spent 40 years trying to understand exactly what happened.
Uh-huh.
And I'm convinced now that it was nothing but hallucinations. And hallucinations, and those who have these experiences without the drugs are also merely hallucinating. They're not revealing a reality. It's just messing up the neurology of the brain itself. That's my argument.
Let me ask, did you want to ask a question before we jump to another?
I was going to say, I think from my own experience that in many ways these drugs duplicate the serotonin release brought about by religious experience.
Okay.
By mantra, mudras, and mandala, which are part parcel of ritual.
Yes.
And when you do ritual, you end up in a place where serotonin is released, and then you have a very similar experience to what they're talking about.
Yes, yes. We won't have opportunity to talk about meditative states too much unless it gets there again. It's slightly different from these different mechanisms, but it is a serotonin system. Now let's ask about the phrase, it is merely hallucinogenic. Anyone want to go for that one?
It's just delusion.
Can it be both?
Yes.
Can it be, use the language of paradoxical?
Yes.
Could it be that God is God as what is not God? To use a Cartesian or a Kantian illustrations,
I, not I. I am not world. World is not I. God, in the Kantian sense, is not I, not world, but not nothing either.
Well, that's an hallucination in itself. You are not separate from the world, so we all live in that particular hallucination.
Very good, very good. Okay. So, in what way does the word God, soul, mind, function? Is it denotative? Does it point, like the word chair points to a chair? Do the terms mind, soul, God point? Yeah, one here, and then we'll go around the table.
In my younger days with these instances, and in my research,
how's that? That's great.
I found that the feeling you get when you're really out there is the scope of everything is enlarged so much. It's a unifying force, so that it's bigger than just me. It's me and things that are beyond it. It's unifying, and those words are tend to cover everything, the whole universe. It knocks away differences, so it points away from individual anything.
Right.
Universal.
What I'm hearing you say is something opposite than this. You're telling me all are universal. If it's all and universal, why select things that are very particular in most Western thought? The mind is not all. My soul is not all, unless we're in Hindu thought, the Atman is Brahman. God is not a chair. It's something particular. It is not the all. So why select these terms to discuss what for you is clearly not particularity? Go ahead.
I'm a Christian, and my thing is that when I was on these drugs, I had the same experience that you had, but I labeled them as artificial. In other words, they were artificial experience because they were not the real thing. And what you showed up there with that psilocybin being a big gap in there.
Yes.
Was that. And I think some people get confused.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's all right.
Okay, very good.
That just brings up a point that what this gentleman was just saying was Russell, is your name?
Craig.
That's right, Craig. That he felt like what he was experiencing was artificial. Can the same point be made for people that are on huge amounts of antidepressants and various psychiatric drugs, that they may not be living an authentic life, they're living a chemically battled life?
Yeah, the world still sucks, but you don't care anymore.
I want to get your comments on that.
All right. Well, let's ask. Serotonin is a naturally occurring substance. Mescaline is a naturally occurring substance. Psilocybin is a naturally occurring substance. So are we suggesting, as long as it's natural, it's authentic, to use that language, authenticity? If not, then we'll need or want to call into question all of pharmacotherapy. Tylenol is not natural. The gas X you're going to need tonight is not natural. Right. Okay. Woke you up. Those are not natural. So are we living an inauthentic life by taking or entering into our body those things which are not naturally occurring, like polyester? Polyester and these sorts of things. What is meant by authenticity? Because I think you've tapped into something very true of these reports. They want to report that this is authentic. This is as real as it gets. So what is meant by authentic experience as well? Well, so this is the authentic mind, the authentic soul, the authentic God, unlike your particular limited religious experience that you had on Friday night at temple or whatever. This is the authentic one.
which is what they claim.
For me, my experience with psilocybin, I call it an ecstatic event in my life. It was life-changing for me, seriously. And so with the question with what is authentic and what is real, what is real? What is real? And real to me is as tangible and solid as this mask here that presents itself as a table. And perception, and each one of our perception, that is what is real. And that's how we live our lives, and that's how we interact with human beings on an everyday basis. In my experience, I saw the colors. I saw the swirling colors, and the music was incredible. Everything was incredible. Everything was heightened. And when I see manifest, create, unmask, it implies to me something that we're not seeing with our everyday eyes, but that is there, behind the mask, behind the all. And so in my experience with the whole unity thing also, I did see everybody as me and one and unity. And I cried for days afterwards, and I was changed, perceivably changed, altered. And this was 4 years ago, I guess, and it was real. And it wasn't an illusion to me, and it wasn't something outside of me. It was, you know, it wasn't God. I mean, I'm a Christian too, but I'm spiritual. I'm spiritual, not, but not religious. But so it wasn't a God thing, but it was a universal consciousness. And it's kind of like you're tapping into the collective consciousness that Jung wants to describe, that we can all tap into, but sometimes we're not able to, for whatever reasons. We have blocks through our experience and environment, nature, all of those type of things. But it was real to me.
Was that the first instance that you had, the first time you had
I had taken it one other time. My son was always saying, Mom, you want to be enlightened? Try mushrooms, right? So I thought, oh, I'm so enlightened. So that should be. But so I was a little nervous about it because I didn't want to fry my brain. But the first time was kind of a nervous type thing, and I did it with my sister and some good friends, and it was just with music. But the second time, I actually, you know, set in setting, and DMT, the spirit molecule, with the research they did on DMT and ayahuasca and those types of things, set in setting, you know, was really a primary influence on your experience. And so in the setting, I created a ceremony of my own accord that I just created out of the blue and made it a sacred event. And I think because of that set and setting, it wasn't just recreational for fun. I think that is what brought my experience to me the way it did. And I wasn't expecting it at all.
One other question. How would you say you're changed now?
Before, you know, I would always compare myself to other people, and, you know, I still do some comparisons and things like that, but when I saw everybody as myself, they truly morphed into me. I would see mountains morph into me. I saw Olympic skiers and extreme sports people and artists and all these people, the images that I had in my head, they morphed into me. And when I realized that everybody was me and I'm in everybody, all of a sudden, I was able to just love people for who they are. And so when I would drive down the road and somebody would cut me off, I'd go, oh, look at that asshole. But that asshole is an aspect of myself, and I still love the asshole because a part of me that day was being, you know, that way. So
let's get the, in the back. One more, and then we'll move on.
We'll open up to questions then.
What time have we got here?
Got 8:34. We try to wrap up maybe the next 5 or 10 minutes, and then maybe.
Well, we've had some discussion, so I'm going to go on, and then we'll discuss some more.
Okay.
We'll have another talk period.
Okay. One last.
Because I want you to know what's happening in the brain when you're experiencing this all kinds of thing, how it affects our language.
Go ahead. Well, that's actually one of mine. It should be on. Yeah, this thing's coming on and comes off.
Okay. Just talk loud.
Okay, is it working?
Yes.
Louder than that.
So you mentioned language. So that was kind of a question I had. It was about semiotics. And if,
for instance, these experiments have been done in an Australian Aboriginal tribe. What words would they have selected to describe their experience? And I guess the other thing is I'm kind of interested in the comments about how people know when their serotonin levels go up or down, they know what causes it.
What causes the serotonin to go up and down?
Well, which causes them to have these feelings.
Okay, good. I'm going to skip over this next one. I want you to just keep this in the back of your mind as well when we talk about our sense of self, which is going to be absent with serotonin mimickers. If I report that I experience myself differently in an altered state, who exactly is having that experience? Does that make sense? If I am somewhere else, this altered sense coming out of myself, looking back upon my life, who's having the experience while I'm doing the observing? Let's keep going and see if I can unravel some of these things a little bit. Consciousness is a hierarchical, dynamical, and intersubjective process. Consciousness is not a thing like tables and chairs.
Thank you.
Okay. First, hierarchical. And I like the brain again. Consciousness at the most basic level of being awake or being asleep has to do with what's going on in the brainstem. The reticular formation, the ventral tegmental area, and the locus ceruleus in the brain, particularly the locus ceruleus and the ventral tegmental, respond to those things that are novel and sudden. If someone were to drop a plate out there in the restaurant, you would jump and you would turn. It is because of these lower areas of the brain that shift your focus in that direction. So very important. But this is the most basic level. If we don't have the basic level, you're out. It's unconscious. The next level will build on top of that, making consciousness more complex. And that happens here in the thalamus, that switching station where all sensation except the olfactory come through there and are channeled into to the cortex. The occipital lobe here in the back, the parietal lobe here, giving us our sense of space and time, not time, but space and where our body is. If we lose function here in the parietal lobe, I can't tell the difference between me and the floor that I'm standing on, and you might collapse like a boneless chicken. This happens in meditative states, as blood is shunted away from the parietal lobe to concentrate very intently. And the blood is moving to the prefrontal cortex, particularly that ventral medial prefrontal cortex. And the blood moves away from this area, and you lose this sense of your body. For this, I'll point you as well to the work of a radiologist in neuroscience. I don't think I brought it to you this book. Yes, Newman, Why God Won't Go Away. It's an awful title. It has nothing to do with God. But what's going on during a meditative state, sitting Buddhist meditation as well as Carmelite nuns. Very wonderful. So this is the second level. You can have no frontal lobe, a frontal lobe lobotomy, and still have consciousness at this most basic level. I perceive. And you can imagine being animals have this area. However, I'm using this metaphorically to speak of higher because it is up in the brain in that sense. Not higher because it is somehow superior, but it's what we call integrated consciousness, where working memory happens. You're able to follow me from the beginning of my sentence to the end of my sentence. If I asked you a question, you could hold that question in working memory and give me an answer. People under psilocybin and other drugs like LSD can't remember what they're telling you in mid-sentence. They'll forget what they were talking about because the working memory is gone. This sense of self, attention, and mindness are a function of this area of the brain. This idea of feeling that I am no longer, that I am falling away, or that I am dissolving into everything. We've got these areas still intact, working, and sending messages, but the sense of self is gone. Particularly because this is where psilocybin has its greatest effect. In the thalamus, we'll sort of move on. The thalamus sending these connections up to the cortex and then looping back down. Some of you who've done consciousness studies or have read, this is referred to as the thalamocortical loop that is believed to be the prime neural correlate of consciousness. Because the information moves from the thalamus to the cortex and back around in a loop, and incidentally, you know who Francis Crick is, co-discoverers of DNA. Francis Crick, in his later life, turned to neuroscience in a book called The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul. And he is credited with part of this early work in that this loop must occur at 40 cycles per second. At 40 cycles per second, consciousness emerges. Lower than that, consciousness falls apart. So anything that will perturbate, disturb, or somehow damage this looping from the thalamus to the cortex will disturb consciousness. And it occurs in sleep as well as in dreams, particularly here at layer 5, which is where these drugs tend to work. I'm going to show you just UC San Diego, several philosophers of mine and neuroscientists have actually mapped, so over a few seconds, what is happening to excitation, these loops that are going on, and get it to work here. Model of the brain, you see the red areas in the brain are areas of stimulation. As the thalamus is sending inputs to the cortex, you see the red areas. And the areas that are brown, which is most of the brain on this side, is the line. You've got enough of it. This loop.
You were going at 40, and then you disturbed it.
I disturbed it.
We're always here.
Right. But there was more brown than there was red. And that's very important for our attending to or focusing on experiences. If you're attending to my voice right now, there must be a loop in that area, the auditory area, that is moving. But as well, there must be a downward inhibition of everything else. If I hush, you're conscious of the shoes on your feet right now. If I hush, you can hear the hum of the projector. But when I'm talking and you're listening to me, you don't hear those things. You don't think about the shoes on your feet or the feeling of the shirt on the back of your neck until I speak it. And at that moment, the thalamus sends that information to the cortex and you experience it. At the same time, it shuts down other areas so that you can focus. With psilocybin, we're disturbing that loop. And when you disturb the loop, focus, sense of self falls away, and sight and sound and past memories all flood in together and mingle in an undifferentiated all to which a self is not attached. And this has to do with the very careful orchestration of the serotonin system. Again, here are these loops that are happening, and these loops are moving at 40 cycles per second. But with psilocybin, what we're going to disturb is the downward loop coming from the left prefrontal cortex and the right prefrontal cortex, particularly the dorsal lateral part, that's what DL stands for. If we perturb or disturb that backward flow to the thalamus, then we're losing our sense of time, we lose our sense of self, we lose this sense of particularity, you lose the sense of free will, my ability to make choices, reality just happens to me, and all of these other experiences from other areas of the brain are still active. They're still cycling at 40 cycles per second. And you're having the experience of color, and when you were a child, and snakes, and sounds, and Jimi Hendrix, and all of it is rolled together, and as the account says, I can't tell the difference between where I begin and the music stops. It all rolls together. And this is what's happening in the brain. So we have corticothalamic loops that inhibit, or we say, actually you're not conscious expanding, their consciousness removing, they're removing pieces. Serotonin is globally available throughout the body. There are multiple chemical pathways, and psilocybin can activate these other pathways as well. So you're getting these other inputs from other areas of the brain where serotonin is active, particularly the amygdala, fear, and distress, particularly with LSD. LSD is one of those strands. Well, no, I'll come to that just a minute. The brainstem nuclei. There's serotonin in the brainstem nuclei. So we're going to shut down, because of serotonin, we're going to shut down the Rofi nuclei as happens with basic consciousness. But serotonin is going to increase the activity of the locus coeruleus in the ventral tegmental area, those areas that are responsible for sudden changes in our environment. So everything you experience is sudden. One of the last accounts that I read, I don't know if you noticed how many times he said, and suddenly, it happened. It was like somebody dropped a plate. I had to turn. I had to experience. I couldn't choose it. But because the Rofi nuclei is offline, it is both awake and asleep. A waking dream. A dream from which I cannot awake, like a lucid dream. Are you familiar with that terminology? And there are other effects of these neurochemicals, direct effects. So GABA and glutamate, I won't get into those. Indirectly, in the case of LSD, Timothy Leary and others of you, LSD is this strange, is this cruel mistress. At first, she gives us this rush of serotonin, and we feel the world is wonderful and all folds into one. But then it's metabolized by the liver. And instead of being excreted from the body, one of its metabolites is also a hallucinogen that looks like dopamine. So it crosses the blood-brain barrier, and you get a second hit in which it has become dopaminergic. And that's where you get the experience of the spiders and the darkness and death and very existential and paranoia. So one up, one down.
A bad trip.
So you can tell that we're getting very structurally complex. It's not just one thing. It is multiple levels of the brain that we can map as if it were a network. But that's structurally. There's this looping back and forth in which, with each experience, the brain is physically changed by each experience. So you're never just moving backward and forward, doing the same old things again and again and again. Physical structure of the brain is being changed like a beautiful dance. And so functional maps look more like something out of chaos theory and fractal geometry. So it's always changing, becoming more and more things. One of my favorite books, Douglas Hofstadter, I Am a Strange Loop. This is not for the faint of heart. If you have some background in mathematics and psychology, this is very good.
It helps if you start with his other one.
Yes. Oh my, really? Okay, summary review. In our ordinary states, I am transparent to myself. I am, and this is my attempt at being Jamesian here, a wispy fabric upon and through which our experiences are woven. We never catch a glimpse of myself. I only see my experience. It's like looking through a window and seeing what's in the shop, but we don't notice the window. But it is the window that is enabling us to see what's in the shop. Imagine children. You know the game we play about trying to open the refrigerator door real quick to see if the light was on? We try to catch a glimpse of consciousness. But consciousness is that which enables our experience of the world. The self, or soul, mind, is itself a construct woven together in and through the sensations that it will elucidate. And so there's this what's called autopoiesis, that biologists have known for a long time, a self-making kind of happening. Self and world come to be in and through the other. I think of phenomenology and Merleau-Ponty, idea of life-world, absolutely. So in the psycholytic state, in the moment consciousness is being pulled apart, it is also being brought to consciousness. That which is broken is the very mechanism by which consciousness we catch out of the glimpse, out of the corner of our eye, as it is happening. And you can't do that with other experiences, except for meditative states. where we slow down the mechanism itself, we can have a more authentic reporting, phenomenological reporting. I think of this work of Escher, right? Or maybe you like Salvador Dali. Self-creating self. I'll skip over the idea of William James. What is the value of these? This could be our discussion now at the end. It addresses consciousness as an ontologically subjective. Consciousness has usually been treated as an object, a thing in the world. And we say it is epistemologically subjective. I have my private experiences that you can't know. It makes it an epistemological problem. Consciousness is itself a subjective reality. And so we must address it, I'm going to suggest, not just from analyzing brain cells, but from a genuine first-person phenomenological investigation, with all the bracketing and so forth that we get. Also, it's interesting to philosophers who want to talk about time. What is time? You slow down the very mechanism by which we experience time. Brain time, by the way, is different from phenomenal time, what we experience. Brain plays tricks on us. So when you slow it down, we're able to say things about time that are not just metaphysical or speculative. With psychedelics, there is experimental controls, there are phenomenological methods I'm going to move through. We do have the language of limits. If you're talking to someone who says, this is ineffable, I can't talk about it. Well, okay, I guess we're done. Then there's nothing I can get from it. And that's when we tend to resort to words that don't seem to fit, that are too interpretive or religious in nature. We want authentic descriptors of the experience, not it feels like God. Maybe the clue is in art. For much of these experiences, you ask, how would the shaman or those in dreamtime and aboriginal cultures, how did they speak of it? They would not speak. They would paint. This is an actual painting. It's not a digital construction. These are called visionary artists. I went to a conference several years ago, and I met some of these visionary artists, and they specialize in psychedelic agents. There's a mescaline artist group, and there's a peyote mescaline. There's a psilocybin group. There's an LSD group. There's a ketamine group. There's a nitrous oxide group. And their art looks very, very different. It's as different as different languages. And through the art, they express to us what it's like to have this.
Which was like, that?
Pardon?
Which prep was that?
a lot of these in the early stages are early LSD. Some of the art isn't as helpful because you get into interpretations. I met Alex Gray while I was there. Alex Gray started as an anatomy illustrator. So his work is very technical, and it looks like it should belong in a medical book. But you can see the interpretation here himself of the linking of the chakras, the crown chakra, the heart chakra here. So those aboriginal cultures or Native American cultures, you might find this. I would like to direct you, for if you're interested in other research, there's lots of research by anthropologists that deal with ophthalmic images. Images within the eye. You've all seen floaters. You know, when you close your eye, you see the floaters. But during psychedelic experiences, there are universal patterns that are almost the same for each one of us, regardless of the particular trip we're on. And these images appear in almost all the cave paintings, in all the sacred art of the world, these particular squiggles. Here's one of these charts that analyzes these and where it is found. So that's an area. Pharmacological benefits. To all of these, you know, that of course in the 70s they shut down these kinds of things, didn't want to get out of hand, and there's just something wrong with saying, just take this and tell me what happens. You know, we don't go to a doctor, and you know, we go for a particular purpose. Is it because of the target? We feel bad that it's the mind, you can't mess with the mind. Is it because it is mystical? Or is it we're afraid we're just going back to the 60s? All right. That's a quick run-through of what's happening in the brain. What I suggest to you that during these experiences where consciousness is psycholytic, is pulled apart, and I would advocate the British model rather than the American model. The American model says you get this huge bolus dose and you go into this huge experience. The British say little by little, carefully, it's like unraveling a knot, very carefully. And from that experience, you've got the third-person accounts that we like in science, the first-person phenomenal accounts that we like in phenomenology, and I think those are kind of bringing that gap together, that in the moment of consciousness, we catch a glimpse of the self as the self is emerging in and through these agents. All right, do we have any time left?
The restaurant's going to be closing shortly, so maybe time for one question, one quick question.
I have one word. Evo game. What can you tell us about Evo game?
I don't know. That was quick. That was quick. I don't know.
You can speak real loudly.
Roland Griffiths at Johns Hopkins is doing a lot of studies with psilocybin now.
Oh, really?
I mean, he's had dozens of people in under the auspices of Johns Hopkins, and he's doing this as a relation to religious experience. Do you see perhaps an opening for, moving back into some serious study of these agents now?
The agents, they can be more purified than they used to be, and so a lot of the negative side effects are going away when you can isolate. There are over 100 different types of mushrooms, and you can imagine different levels and types of psilocybin you get from them. But those things that can be manufactured very carefully.
Five subspecies in Texas alone.
In Texas alone. So it's not just a matter of eating a mushroom. Like, how many mushrooms do you take?
Well, we are out of time. Let's give a round of applause. I want to thank Ms. Love and White Bottom for joining us as well.
Don't do it. Get on the road. I don't want any more patients.